So let's start with, I think Peter will give us an update on the RSP activities.
Okay, so just very briefly, so agenda paper one's got quite a detailed summary of where we are on the various projects. I'll just highlight a couple of things. The board's basically finished the discussions on insurance contracts, on the conceptual framework, and so those are in drafting at the moment. The discussion paper on principles of disclosure is also in the final stages of drafting. We expect to put that out in April. On rate-regulated activities, the board started discussing that again after a bit of a break, and so we'll be seeing that coming to the board more over the next few months. And I guess liabilities, equity, financial instruments with characteristics of equity, the board has been discussing that fairly intensively. It's getting near the end of that discussion, and so we'll see a discussion paper on that later in the year. On the implementation area, we've got a separate section on implementation later in the agenda, so I won't mention any of those things specifically. And those are the main things I wanted to cover. Aida's going to give us a little update on the discount rates in a minute, but first I should perhaps just see whether you have any questions or comments on the agenda. Bob?
A couple, and so if I can tee up one, and then if you're willing to come back to me on another, and I'll just touch loosely on discount rates, but I know you're going to get to it. It has to do with the post-implementation review of IFRS 13. And try and say this at a higher level for maybe discussions is, concern's not the right word, but it seems, and maybe I'm not following it close enough, that all these reviews, post-implementation reviews from the FASB and the IASB, it just seems to me as a practitioner that they come back with no material issues. And I know that's maybe not factually correct. Maybe that is factually correct, but no material issues. And let's not debate the word material right now. And I'm just wondering if maybe the board needs to do some introspection of these. I missed the last GPF meeting, and I think there was a robust discussion about fair value, and I think about this review, and there was P times Q issues, there's disclosure issues, and I'm not trying to belittle it because what you've done with, this is my 10th year, we have one more meeting after this, and I want to thank the IASB. This group has come leaps and bounds from 10 years ago, and the way you respond back to the way you're looking at our stuff. But I just get concerned, quite honestly, that the comments get into board papers, and then it's in board papers, and there's not much debate. But my real point is, it just seems that there's maybe, when you go fair value of, maybe you don't want to redebate P versus Q, but we brought it up. There's the disclosure issues. And then, I know fair value, and when we talk about IFRS 13, it's something maybe in particular, but now we're going to talk about discount rates, and discount rates are fair value. And so it's like, is there silos, just like we do in companies, of silo thinking? I just urge the ISB, from my opinion, we discussed it, and Kevin may want to add, he had a good comment, but I'll let him do that. I'm not getting in trouble right away. Is that I'd like to see maybe a little bit more introspection. And Kevin, if you want to tee up, that's maybe the perfect time for you to make your comment.
So where I think, like I'm on Bob's page, that there is a perception post-implementation reviews are the headmaster marking his own work. As global preparers, I spend at least 40% of my year dealing with divergence in interpretation in each country. And therefore, it's relatively simple to review something at the helicopter level, because if you do ask, and I'll use because they're not here, there's no country represented here, but if you ask, have you got any issues with IFRS 13 in Argentina, you'll get told no. Any issue with IFRS 13 in Australia, you'll get told no. But if you give them both the same transaction, you might end up with different answers. And so you only know what you know, you don't know, you'd never know what you don't know. But the divergence is actually getting quite bad from my perspective, purely because the local audit firms are not getting necessarily support from the global desks, or the global desks are not going down to the local firms. And so IFRS implementation in countries over the last, that have adopted in the last 4 or 5 years, I'm seeing more and more it was old home country gap being interpreted into IFRS as opposed to IFRS being applied. And that's where we see the divergence. And because the home country auditor doesn't know that it's potentially wrong, or doesn't, therefore doesn't ask the global desk, and the global desk doesn't know it's occurring. And so that's what I think we've got to find a way of doing the post-implementation review to tease out those issues in order to identify improvements.
Can I make a few comments on that then? And I think there are several different issues sort of intertwined in that. And I'll ask Aida's comments as well, because she's on the IFRS 13 PIR and also doing the discount rate work. In terms of the PIR, first of all, this is the third one we'll have done. So we've done the IFRS 8 one. We're actually about to publish in the next few weeks, the ED that's resulting from the IFRS 8 PIR. On business combinations, IFRS 3, we identified three areas that we thought needed follow-up as a result of the PIR, and the board is working through those. It's goodwill impairment issues, and we've had some discussions in this group already, but there's quite a long way I think still to go in those discussions, and those are certainly more than just a conclusion that everything's fine, because it seemed there were some issues to look at. So it's, and the IFRS 13 one is just kicking off really. We've had the first round and the board has approved that we're going to issue a request for information, which will be designed to gather more information about how the IFRS 13 one is working. In terms of the process and who should do it, I mean, we've got a slightly different approach from the FASB. The FASB is actually done by their trustees. The model they took was that it's better to take it out of the standard setting board and have a slightly separate body, although still in the same building, looking at it. There are good arguments on both sides, I think, for the best way to do that. I think the issues Kevin was talking about, sounds to me as though those are not necessarily connected to the things we'd be looking at necessarily in a PIR. So the PIR is designed to test a relatively recently issued standard after there's been some time to look at how it's operating in practice and to see whether there are, you know, unexpected things happening. But I think what Kevin's talking about is probably much broader. It's about the whole suite of standards. It's not just a particular standard that happens to have been issued recently. So I think that probably raises a completely separate set of valid questions for us to think about. And I think you can have a good dialogue with us, probably about the best way to.
I think it's feasible to commence it.
Yeah.
Through the PIR, because if the statement has been adopted recently, but there wasn't a home country, like fair value, let's take, in the home country it was permitted to use something that wasn't necessarily 100% ticked to the stock market price. So now in the IFRS, are they still on not 100% ticked to the stock market price, or have they moved to 100% ticked to the stock market price? Unless that specific question is asked, do you do fair value by reference to the stock? Yes. You get yes to that answer everywhere, but that reference might be 10% either side of whatever the price is. So it's like, what is the question you're asking? Because you might ask the question to get your desired answer, as opposed to tease out an issue.
I saw Gary trying to come in, so do you want to?
No,
okay.
First in the queue.
Thank you. May I ask the question on your urgency? Actually, thanks to your discussion on the last November, in the paper, the 1A, you raised all the important issues on IFRS 13, P times Q, and level 3 disclosure. You did excellent discussions you have made last November. So what I'm asking is, do you have any other way, in addition to this, what you suggested to us, to reduce such kind of divergence? Any specific some ideas?
I can only give you the ones that I specifically come across, and I've got one that's I'm chatting to Michael Stewart on. I've got one country in the world where we use as our corporate US dollar functional currency, and now they have to do presentation currency. And in that particular country, no one's adopting the presentation currency IS-21, whatever the paragraph is on presentation. They're redoing as if that country's currency is its functional currency. And the audit firms have accepted it, and it's obviously not in compliance with IS-21 in its entirety. So, you know, this. But, you know, are you applying IS-21? You'll all be answered yes, because no one's going to ask the question, what are you doing on functional currency to presentation currency?
I'm not sure if I'll be responsive to your question, because I'm not sure if you were looking for additional items, but just to give from a preparer's standpoint, and I know that that's a bias standpoint, in when talking about IFRS 13, and I don't know if the purpose of the reviews is redebate things. You know, a lot of us on the P times Q is just, if we're trying to estimate, I know it's a thorny issue, but if we're trying to estimate future cash flows, P times Q just does not do it. And I don't know if it's time to redebate that, but maybe more importantly is the disclosures. And I'm more familiar with US GAAP than international standards, but we talk about level three, but even 1, 2, 3. And I'll just give the example of Microsoft. I was a treasury controller, so I was responsible for the accounting and the footnotes for our treasury operations. And Microsoft has a big treasury operation, over $100 billion in investable assets, pretty conservatively invested. If you picked up Microsoft's financial statements and footnotes without knowing what company you're looking at, and try to take away identifying information, you think we're wrong. And that's a problem. My team as treasury controller was responsible for more than 50% of the footnote volume in Microsoft's financial statements. And it was level 1, 2, and 3 disclosures and, you know, just derivative netting. And I know we had the financial crisis, and I know this is important, but I'd like to just see, getting back to my words, some deeper introspection. I know you can't be masters to everybody, but just an example, a company like Microsoft, and this is the product we're producing by these great people around this table, and for me to sit here and say, if you didn't know better, you think Microsoft is a bank, is just a bad indictment on all of us. And you can't solve all the problems, but that's why I'd like to see some of the introspection.
Okay, but if you have 100 billion of financial assets, man, you are bigger than a bank. Why is that bad? Why is that disclosure then bad? Because, man, if you compare it to some of banks in my home country, you have more financial assets than.
Well, Martin, I think you missed the point to me debate you. Is that?
No, you have
Microsoft. Both. No. Microsoft's market cap is close to $400 billion. So that is about 1/4 of it, conservatively invested. If you were an investor in Microsoft, what would, and you don't need to answer this, but what would you want to know? And I think like number 10 on your list would be minutia after minutia after minutia on financial instruments. What you'd want to know is, what is Microsoft doing with intellectual capital, human capital, relation capital? Why did Microsoft pay $26 billion for LinkedIn? Because of the network effects. And so I get it, but these are how these conversations dissolve, is we bring them down one level and start debating of $100 billion. But if you were an investor in Microsoft, I challenge you that probably the 10th item on your list would be financial instruments.
I mean, I agree to that, but I think your problem is you're saying, okay, it is a kind of, if you're doing a post-implementation review of 13, we should, my understanding is, come up from a bigger picture, right? Because we should not looking at individual things. Or, because I don't understand it, because if you're looking at the BIR form from 13, clearly my disclosure was mentioned, and clearly disclosure by an kind of, especially of an industrial company or a non-bank, doing too much disclosure on fair value. I understand that. Yes. And we will look at that. I think that is addressed.
I think it's probably the most important issue raised, wasn't it?
My second point, I think, Gary, once we move on, if I can just make my second point, which will more address your issue, and it gets more than a PRI, we're kind of, but Gary, or whoever's next, I just wanted to come up with a different issue before we get off of this one.
Gary?
I guess my question, this probably goes back to your first remarks as opposed to back here. With the introspection, short of reopening the basic issues, I don't know how we would do that. I mean, if you think of the purpose of PIR, it's not to re-debate the conclusions. Yeah. Is it proving more difficult than you thought in the first instance? And what you're trying to set out to accomplish in communication would be disclosure, measurement. Is it working? Or is someone using it? Yeah. I mean, that's not reopening the basic issues, but I think that's what you're doing, is should you go back and revisit, the fundamental conclusions. So I don't know. The introspection has to occur when the standard is written, not in the postmortem that's several years after the fact.
That's fair.
I do think, though, when the U.S. isn't there, but between the amendments we made to IAS-1 on materiality, the materiality practicing, which will be out in 2 months, a lot of what you just complain about, if you could make the argument it's immaterial, you don't have to do it. In fact, we're going as far out of the way as we possibly can, or don't clutter up with irrelevant stuff. You know, that's going to take a bit of arm wrestling, and it's just easier to do, perhaps, than to demonstrate it's immaterial and appreciate.
Yep.
The U.S. regulatory environment has its own challenges compared to other countries. But, I mean, I think the IS-1 amendments are 2 years ago, and we're working on now.
Yeah.
A lot can be done with those. Yeah. It absolutely can.
Let me make the second point, which really it doesn't have to do with the PIR, and I wanted to bring it up a level if I can, and those are great points, and the purpose of PIR is that the second point I wanted to make is I didn't see management commentary in the paper, and maybe that's fine. I could have swore I heard Hans talking about it, but maybe I'm wrong, is that the IASB may want to relook at management commentary. And this is what I want to make as the meta point is, in my new job, I'm biased for integrated reporting. But I really think and would encourage you to look at a management commentary project to help our profession go to maybe a more holistic type of thought process. And you don't need to, I would encourage you to follow the IR framework. I think it's good with a multi-capital view. And I think you can do that in management commentary. Your first foray into management commentary, I think, was good, but it's kind of gets like MD&A is supposed to be an explanation of what's going on in the financial statements. But the problem is, what's missing from the financial statements are major value drivers like intellectual capital, human capital, relational capital. I commend this organization for the leadership that they've shown in issues like IR. And I don't think, you're going to have the mandatory versus practice statement. It'd be difficult with the jurisdictional requirements of management commentary and MD&A around the world to make it mandatory. So I think a practice statement is good. But I think the ISB can really lead the way in maybe this profession getting out of what I think is a conundrum that we've been in 20 years now of we moved way past the manufacturing economy. I think we missed, as accountants, the information economy, and whatever the economy we're in now is probably going to change 2 years from now anyways. It's time for us to catch up. You can do it a really good service in them with management commentary. Canada has an MD&A that I'm told is very similar to the IR framework. Kevin, if he wants to, can talk about integrated reporting in South Africa. Your former board member Stanford, Mary Barth, is doing research in this area because you can do archival work now with the departments in South Africa. You know, it's always hard to look at academic research and you need paper after paper, but she is showing with archival research that integrated reporting leads to higher liquidity, higher future cash flows, And it's a combination, they believe, the academics believe, of more transparent reporting and what we call integrated thinking, which is a company thinking differently. And a company like Microsoft is we can think differently about intellectual capital, human capital, and things like that. And so I would urge you, I thought I heard Hans talk about it, but I could be wrong, that I think that would be a very important project, in my opinion, for the ISB to show its leadership.
And one comment to that, because, and I think we just have finished the agenda consultations and effect analysis, and these topics clearly were discussed. Should we really focus on the wider corporate reporting, integrated reporting, and should we, also your comment earlier, should we maybe do a project on intangible assets, intellectual capital, because when you're saying we are focusing mainly on financial instruments or not on what is not on the balance sheet. Everything was discussed, I think, in the gender consultation, but based on what we heard from others, we should not go into this area of wider corporate reporting. The trustees have decided that we should do some work, and maybe from this some work we do something, and I heard also this kind of, maybe we should do the kind of, do some leadership role and say, okay, what goes into the kind of core report. We're discussing that, but at least it was not the focus what we got heard from other stakeholders, because they said, okay, we should stay to the financial statements and should maybe not forget that, look into that, but that really should not be the focus. I understand you, what you have said, that is a few of some, but it was not of the majority. Neither what kind of this effect analysis that the trustees have undertook, not what we heard in the agenda consultation. I personal opinion maybe is different, but that was at least, I think, recently we have consulted on that, and that was a feedback which we heard, and then based on that feedback we have decided where we should focus our work.
I think, but just Gary, you in the interest of time, this very subject or your plea for work will be discussed at this month's board meeting. I actually seen the papers on it. I'm not predicting where it will come out, but it's very much in there, and you know, in a few days the papers will be publicly available. Invite comments to come in advance of it, but it's on the discussion.
Kevin?
So, Gary, I'll take issue with you because I think you need to ask two questions, not one. So I think if you ask the question, has IFRS 13 been implemented as we intended? Yes. I can answer that right now. You don't need to do a PIR. Is it producing useful, relevant, and reliable information? No.
Well, the
depending on the industry, and I know you don't want industry-specific accounting standards, but
the PIR coming out actually is dealing. The number one issue was the volume and the relevance of the disclosures, and should only be level three, or should be all of them. And that's what's going out.
But
in the second round for comments, is the disclosures achieving their objective? Now it's not reopening. You know. Should you clean sheet of paper and revisit the disclosures, you know, you might conclude, and by the way, like most things, you know, the input's mixed.
Yeah.
You know, as some say it's not enough, some say it's way overkill, you know.
And that's why I say I think the question's got to go, as much as the ISB doesn't want it, it's got to keep considering it. The costs of necessarily preparing level three disclosures for industrials are absolutely horrendous. Compared to what might be a bit simpler for financial institutions.
Maybe,
and those type of questions that if you're doing those, what is the cost, what is the effort? It might end up being useful information, but at the cost and effort, it's destroying shareholder value. So at what point in time does the destruction of shareholder value get balanced against the cost of preparing the information? And I think those are the questions that need to be
And Kevin, this is specifically actually one of the questions. We are drafting, so it's not ready yet, the RFI or IFRS 13, but we are intending, or with the draft that Gary and Changu have reviewed, includes questions about cost versus benefits, so not just overall usefulness. And we have really, I mean, recognizing Bob's point, it was very high level review in the phase one. It was intended as a high level because otherwise we'll be doing it for much longer time. Overall feedback we did hear was that there was very positive statements about IFRS 13 improving financial reporting significantly. However, you know, all the comments that you've made is valid, and especially, Kevin, what you said last time with the examples of the local audit firms and not connected to the global practice has really stuck with us as a team, so we're really having that in mind. So when we actually go and do the detailed research in the phase two, we are intending to kind of dig down and try to understand the differences between countries and regions. And I just dare say, maybe by expressing interest in this, maybe Bob and Kevin are going to be our volunteers from the preparer side to dig deeper in the disclosures, because one of the exercises we are planning, apart from the usual outreach which will cover all the questions, is to have some deeper discussions, maybe workshop type of exercises where we maybe use some case studies and look at the examples of how these disclosures work, sit with investors, what exactly here is useful, because they've been saying lots of things here that are useful for them, and then just, you know, share with preparers, but actually how much effort does it take to prepare this. So maybe, if you don't mind, we can...
Kevin, we just ran into it.
But it doesn't worry me.
No, that's
fine. Can I ask you to do it in twofold? Because you get consolidated responses, and you specifically ask your responders to split their responses between industrials and non-industrials and sort of give you greater granularity in the response. And following on from the discussion we had in our admin session, please find out what your users are actually using. I will give you our history. We publish our full year preliminary results. We publish them early February. And within a week of that, there's 30-odd analyst reports on my financials, on that preliminary. We publish our annual report at the end of March. I can count on no hands the number of analyst reports that come out based on the annual financial statements. So when you ask the question of the user, what is it you are using, you need to ask them, and from what source? Because there's very few analysts, in my perception, that are looking at annual financial statements. They're looking at the abbreviated preliminary stuff that comes out, and therefore we need maybe to concentrate on the information that's useful for that, because that's what they're using, as opposed to the 300-page document.
Yeah, but... I agree to that, but isn't it a different issue? Because clearly, man, if you make an earnings release, the analyst focusing on your earnings. But if they're doing fundamentals research study, they're looking at your financial statements on your balance sheet, on your risk disclosure and others. Because you cannot say, okay, because we have more analyst coverage from earnings release, does not conclude for me that all this disclosure in the annual statement is not necessary.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's not
but
necessary.
But it was a little bit like hearing that, because... I think it's different issues. I mean, clearly, we understand that there is not so much press or analyst coverage with a publication of an annual statement compared to a press or to an earnings release. I totally understand that. But what we are hearing from ZMA groups, there is still a place for this more disclosure in annual statements, because that is when they do fundamental analysis of certain issues, they're using that. Because clearly, when we had this customer disclosure initiative project, is that all necessary? Yeah. Are people using that? And the feedback, yes, it was clear. People are using that.
Yeah. So I'm asking the question, for what are you using it, as opposed to are you using it? Because they're all using it, but if they're not using it, for what reason, as opposed to, because it's like everything else in the disclosure initiative. Once you've got it, it's harder to take it away.
Okay, I think we have understood, and Maida has confirmed that we are addressing this disclosure for fair value. But we also think about, okay, what is it necessary maybe to split between a bank and a non-bank, because I think that is the main issue. Other than that, any comments on the update? Current issues seems not to be the case.
So I should just say that Agenda Paper 1A has got a summary of what you discussed in the November meeting and sort of what's happened since then. So we should just see if anybody's got any comments or questions on that.
Okay.
So then Aida's going to give us a brief update that you asked for on the discount rate product.
Do we have time?
Can I just say, and I mentioned this, is thank you very much. This group, as I said, I'm repeating myself, as I have one more meeting. I've been doing this for 10 years. And just thank you for listening to our comments. We've come a long way in 10 years, and so thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Stanley.
Okay, so I will just...
Okay, before we...
Yeah, on the research projects, the goodwill and impairment, what exactly is the scope of the research? Is the research limited to how to ease the process of impairment testing, or can it be made a little broad-based as to whether the concept of impairment testing itself can be questioned or not? This is a very important question now being faced by many companies.
Yeah.
That is the impairment testing, is the compulsory annual testing, impairment testing, right or not? So, if the research is broad-based enough to capture that or no?
It's probably not quite as broad-based as that. So, we're following up three issues that were identified in the post-implementation review of IFRS 3 on business combinations. So, the first is to do with goodwill amortization versus impairment, and is it right to stick with no amortization versus impairment only? But I think even if the board decided to reintroduce amortization, I think there would still need to be an impairment test of some kind. In fact, there was an impairment test before IFRS 3 was introduced, and we have impairment tests for all other assets. So I don't think the board would remove the requirement to do an impairment test. But whether it be the same impairment test, of course, is another question. Secondly, we're looking at the impairment test itself and seeing whether there are improvements we can make. And there are two aspects of the improvement. The first is people have argued that it's maybe not effective enough and doesn't pick up impairments on a timely basis. And then the second question is, it's of course quite complex to operate, and are there ways to simplify it as well? So the board has looked to some extent at whether we can make it more rigorous, and now we're going to look at whether there are ways we can make it more operational, less costly to implement. Of course, those two aspects may go in opposite directions to some extent, so it may be difficult to find a solution that sort of satisfies both simultaneously, but the board will look at those. And the third aspect we're looking at is, do we have the right balance in terms of which intangibles are identified separately? Is it too many, too few, or about right? And of course, all those three aspects really are interrelated as well. So the board is looking at them as a package. The board had quite a lot of discussions last year. It's not discussed over the last few months, mainly because we've had some staff reallocations, but we're starting up again the discussion. Well, actually, at this meeting, in fact, we've got the first real discussion for a few months.
So where I'm coming from is that increasingly many companies are now realizing that this annual testing of testing effectively results in internally generated goodwill over a period of time to be replacing the goodwill you have upon it. So in effect, whether you agree or you don't agree, in effect, you are indulging in the practice of recognizing internally generated goodwill. So that is in conflict with the principle laid down.
Of course.
So that is one reason. Therefore, I'm saying that there is a scope, huge scope, for challenging the principle itself. After this change was made, Now is it not the right time to see whether this was the change in the right direction, and why this will not be included in the scope of the research?
Well, as I said, I think it's very unlikely the board will take away the requirement to do some sort of impairment test, whatever happens with goodwill. The point you made about the purchase goodwill being replaced gradually by internally generated goodwill is a very well-known point anyway. The board well aware of that. But no test is going to be perfect. You have to accept there's going to be some inconsistencies in the way it works.
Okay, if the recommendation was from GPF, will you include this in this call? And then it will not be included.
Well, I think the board is still. Well, we're going to discuss this topic later anyway, aren't we? So we can perhaps come back to that when we get to it. So maybe we could park that question for an hour or two until we come back to the discussion.
Okay. Then we go on now to Aida.
I'll be very brief. So I've just summarised paper 1B, which gives you an update on the status of discount rates research. And the staff have over the last couple of years conducted research projects on the use of discount rates in present value measurements in IFRS standards, and the objective of this work was to first understand where there are differences in IFRS requirements with respect to discount rates, and understand or trying to identify the reasons why those differences exist, and then finally identify whether there are any differences that staff think are potentially unjustified and should be considered for the board, by the board, to be assessed in a standard setting project. So we did conduct this work, and I think we discussed with you our findings some time ago. Now, in the light of 2015 agenda consultation, the board has no plans to carry out comprehensive standard setting project on discount rates, nor do a targeted project that specifically deal with discount rates. However, there was a number of individual projects, such as goodwill and impairment we just discussed, that are picking up individual findings from the discount rates research and taking it forward as a part of their project and addressing it that way. Still, this leaves us a couple of areas that the board is not attending that were findings in our research, but the board is currently has no plans to address. One is use of inconsistency between use of OCI and profit or loss, and the other one is a comprehensive review of IAS 19 and discount rates and the overall measurement objective. These were discussed in agenda consultation. So what we are doing is we have summarized the findings from our research, and we have also prepared another output from the research, which we called a list of matters for staff to consider in future standard setting. And this is really internal document for staff to consider when developing requirements in the future. And by doing this, we are hoping to facilitate future consistency in standard setting to ensure that all the things we have identified in this research are actually going to be considered in future projects, and the staff are already using this whenever a relevant subject is coming up for the board discussion. And we are planning that in March we are going to have discussion with the board just to finalize the conclusion of this project and formally ask the board whether they want us to do any more work as a part of this research, and ask them to confirm whether they want to conduct any public consultation as a part of this project. And the staff is thinking that neither are necessary in the light of where we are at the moment. And as a final note, we as a staff are planning to bring an education session for the board that will discuss the impact of low and negative interest rates. And this is not a part of this project. It was never in the scope of this project, but because this topic is quite relevant and is coming up in discussion, we thought it might be useful just to bring some examples and just see how that works. So this is where we are. I'm happy to take